coming up Saturday morning at 6 on Hometown Heroes. They're about to embark on an honor flight to the National World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C. But first, they'll take us back in time.
He said, you've been selected for a top secret project, and we'll be in intense training for some time here.
That top secret project changed the world forever. Find out what it was on Hometown Heroes. Bright and early, Saturday morning at 6 a.m. on Power Talk 1360 and 1280.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are heroes around you. There are men and women who you see at the grocery store, the gas station, maybe they're even your next-door neighbors. But if you take the time to ask them about their past, you might just open up the door to some incredible stories. Those are the kind of journeys we take each time on this program, hoping to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, preserve their stories for posterity so their families know and we know what they did, and we don't forget the great price that has been paid for our freedom. Along the way, we sure do learn a lot. We're educated, entertained, and oftentimes inspired by these stories from America's greatest generation. And if you've listened to the program for a while, you've heard me speak quite a bit about an organization called Honor Flight, committed to making it possible for World War II veterans to visit their memorial in Washington, D.C., free of charge. The Honor Flight Network now has nearly 150 different hubs around the country where local volunteers are raising money to make this happen, and more than 100,000 World War II veterans now have been able to make that journey. Wherever you're listening today, there is an Honor Flight hub in close proximity to you, so I hope that you'll encourage the veterans in your life to apply for this free trip of a lifetime, and I'd encourage you to get involved too, because it might just change your life. These flights are happening just about every day all over the country, but there's one that's about to take place that is quite unique because of the runway that this chartered jet is going to take off and land on. It's the historic runway at what was Castle Air Force Base in Atwater, California, a base that opened in 1941, just months before America entered World War II, trained pilots throughout World War II and well beyond. For decades, people growing up in the area got used to that sound of giant planes overhead, whether it was B-29s in the late 40s or B-52s and their giant refueling friends, the KC-135s in the 80s and 90s. The base was closed, though, during the Clinton administration in 1995. If you visit the area today, you'll still find a lot of that history. You'll find dozens of planes on display at Castle Air Museum, from the supersonic SR-71 Blackbird to the monstrous B-36 Peacemaker. A former Air Force One is there now, and many of the World War II planes that we hear about so much on this program, the B-17, B-24, B-25, B-29, you name it. Castle Air Museum keeps the great history of the base alive every day, but it's going to be celebrated and enriched in a really exciting way this Monday, October 27th, when more than 65 World War II veterans from an 8-county corridor of California take off from Castle's historic runway on a special mission to Washington, D.C. It's put together by Central Valley Honor Flight, and some of the veterans on the flight actually flew bombers and tankers off of that very runway during their time in the service. Of course, every veteran on the flight has a story to tell. So I thought, while I encourage anyone who is in Central California to be there at Castle for the send-off Monday morning around 7, and definitely to be there for the welcome home Wednesday night, October 29th at about 5:30, let's also get some perspective on who some of these men and women are who will be embarking on this very special mission. I did say women. There are four of them on board: Asian Americans, African Americans, Hispanic Americans, Native Americans, Army, Navy, Marine Corps, Coast Guard, every branch of service. It's quite a cross-section, and we're going to hear from a couple of those vets today. First, an unassuming man who was up close and personal with the top secret project that helped bring World War II to a close. You know, before Hometown Heroes was airing on all the different stations it's on now, it started in 2007 on a single station, KMJ in Fresno, California. It still airs on KMJ. And one of the veterans I first interviewed that first year was a gentleman named Norris Jernigan. He's 89 now, and he will be on this honor flight from the former Castle Air Force Base. In fact, he was at Castle Air Museum last week for a gathering of the veterans going on this flight. That was pretty special. A local cattle rancher named Jim Cunningham and his team of volunteers donated and cooked up a great feast for the vets. And the veterans received guided tours of the historic planes and the other displays there. And I just happened to come across the tour group that Mr. Jernigan was a part of. Their guide had stopped in front of the B-29, and he was relating the story of the Enola Gay, the atomic bomb, and Colonel Paul Tibbetts. Mr. Jernigan was in that group, and he quietly said, "Paul Tibbetts was my commanding officer." The tour guide heard him, I think, but he continued on with his story. And I apologize for this later, but I interrupted, and I said, "Did you hear what he just said?" The tour group was there looking at a B-29, kind of like the Enola Gay, but the guy standing next to him was actually part of the story. That was a pretty surreal moment. And they didn't have time to sit down and listen to Mr. Jernigan's entire story, but we're going to hear a good chunk of it here. And if you do make it out to Castle to welcome home these veterans on October 29th, maybe you can shake his hand. He grew up on a farm near Galt, California, and he remembers what it was like there after the news of the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor.
We believed in the country, and we recognized that we had been attacked, and it was attractive to all the young men to get involved in the military. And as I saw a lot of my high school friends starting to disappear and going into the military, and then my older brother went into the military. And that, of course, was what eventually would happen to us if the war lingered on that long.
And it did, because the war was still going on as your 18th birthday approached in June of 1943.
Yes, I was sworn in the day before I was 18 so that I would not have to register for the draft. If I had waited one more day, I would have had to register for the draft, and I didn't want to do that. I wanted to select my own branch of service. I had originally wanted to be a pilot, so I enlisted in the Army Air Corps cadet program and went through partial training of that until they reached a point where all of the flight schools, bombardier schools, the navigator schools were filled to capacity at that particular time, and so they eliminated about two-thirds of our school squadron. So out of 240 guys in our school squadron, only about a third of them made it on to a higher level of training.
I know that had to be a crushing blow, as I've heard so many others describe over the years. They sent you to Amarillo, Texas for aircraft mechanics school. You were going to learn that, then aerial gunnery, but they closed that school. They sent you to Salt Lake City. You'd never heard of the 509th Composite Group, and all these left turns and right turns and spinning in circles had to be confusing. But in the end, God's plans are always better than ours. And, you know, it made you a part of some real historic developments.
We were sent to Fairmont, Nebraska to become a B-29 outfit. And it was a long time before they were able to get B-29s there for the crews. And they were training in B-17s. We were part of the 504th Bomb Group at that time. And our squadron was the 393rd Bomb Squadron. Finally, that first B-29 arrived, and we all dashed out to get a close-up of it, and it was immediately surrounded by MPs guarding it and with their guns drawn, and because it was still a pretty secret thing, and the B-29 was early on in its history.
Did you ever look at it and say, "I'm not sure that's really going to fly"?
Not really, because I saw it come in, and I thought, that's the most beautiful thing in the world.
But it would be carrying the most devastating thing in the world before long. What did you know, if anything, at this point about the atomic bomb?
Well, we knew it was a top secret weapon. It was a bomb that had never been used before, and so we were just referred to it as the gimmick all the time. We didn't refer to it as an atomic bomb. In fact, I never heard the phrase atomic bomb until after the bomb was dropped, because we just didn't talk about it. I'm sure some of the intelligence officers that I worked for knew the full title of the thing, but I did not until the day that it was dropped. Let's back up just a little bit. As I said before, I was in the 393rd Bomb Squadron and part of the 504th Bomb Group at Fairmont, Nebraska. Unbeknownst to us, Colonel Paul Tibbetts was given an assignment to develop a military unit, train them, and be prepared to deliver this bomb when it was fully developed. He toured around different bases looking at bomb squadrons that were well advanced in their training. And our 393rd Bomb Squadron, of which I was part of, was his selection. All of a sudden, orders came through that our whole squadron was being pulled out of the 504th Bomb Group and sent to Wendover, Utah. Well, we'd never heard of Wendover, Utah either until we got there, out there on the edge of the salt flats. It's right on the Utah-Nevada border, stretched out there on the salt flats. A desolate place. Mm. And that was the site he selected to develop this this 509th composite group and train them there for security purposes. When we arrived at Wendover, they called an assembly of us, and we all gathered around the orderly room. And this lieutenant colonel that we had never seen before stepped up on the back of a weapons carrier truck and addressed the group. He said, "Gentlemen, I'm Colonel Paul Tibbetts. And you're here because I've brought you here. You're here for a purpose." He said, "You've been selected for a top secret project, and we'll be in intense training for some time here. Everything is going to be secrecy. Security is high priority. You're not to talk about what you're doing here. You're not even to tell anybody that you are here. You're not to discuss your unit at all. If you do, there'll be consequences." Now, everybody is released to go on a two-week furlough. Well, that was good news.
That sounds like pressure, though, to me. Well, you're a 19-year-old kid. They just tell you you're working on something top secret.
Oh,
now you're supposed
yes.
to go for 2 weeks and not talk
yeah,
about it?
Yeah, how can you not talk about it? Well, some did talk about it, and all of a sudden they had orders arrive saying return to your base immediately and were met with discipline. There was one example that I've heard about it. I guess it's true. I think I heard Paul Tibbetts say this at one time. One of the young men was sitting at a bar and sitting next to a priest, and the priest started questioning him a little bit, and he thought, well, you can't go wrong telling everything to a priest. So he kind of opened up a little bit and talked a little more than he should and said that we were out there on a secret training mission to do something spectacular, that and Tibbetts had told us at this assembly that this should shorten the war by 2 years at least. Well, we were all, that was good news. And, you know, it's hard not to spread that around if you think you're going to bring this thing to a conclusion, because it was still a long, drawn-out war. And when he arrived back at the base, the priest was no longer in his priestly garb, but was in civilian clothes, and he was FBI.
Mm-hmm.
He was shipped out immediately. We never knew where he went. We never did hear. I didn't know the person. I assume it's true. You know, and you hear all these other stories about different ones that were tapped on the shoulder by somebody and saying, "You're talking too much." The purpose of this furlough was not only to give us a little bit of rest before we went into the intense training, but also to test everybody. And so there were a lot of FBI agents all over the place. At railroad stations and bus stations, air depots, I guess.
So clearly you passed the test.
Evidently. I guess they just didn't hear when I was telling my folks all about it.
Did you tell your folks all about it?
I'm sure I did. I must have mentioned that it was really something great and they'd be hearing about us. But anyhow, we got back to the base and went into the intensive training. The first thing they did was cut our crew number down from 20 to 15, and also the number of our airplanes, and completely modified the 15 airplanes that were left, taking out all the gun turrets except the tail gun. So they stripped them of all the armament, and of course, nobody knew that the why of that either, but it was to lighten the load, because these bombs were going to be about 10,000 pounds apiece. I'm sure we all questioned what in the world is going on here, because the crew started having to fly special missions with a lot of sandbags to load the airplane down. And also, they were disappearing for a week or two at a time to where we called Destination X. They were going to somewhere in Southern California, out on Inyo Desert, I think, for special bomb drop training. So it was just all kinds of things happening. And then during the training, about January of 45, Colonel Tibbetts decided he wanted his crews to do some practice bombing missions, flying over water to do over water navigational missions. So he started sending about four or five crews at a time down to Havana, Cuba. Well, it's right near Havana, Cuba, at Batista Airfield.
Mm-hmm.
And we were at a little town called San Juan Batista. There again, we had security people right with us all the time. We were allowed to go on weekend leave into Havana, but we were always bumping into these guys in civilian clothes that we could see at the base, too. So, you know, you learn to keep your mouth shut.
Well, this had all started when they sent you to Nebraska. How'd you end up in this top secret unit to begin with?
They classified me as a truck driver. Well, I'd never driven a truck before in my life, and that, again, was the wisdom of the military, you know. There was a sergeant in the orderly room. Orderly rooms are the headquarters office for your squadron or your group or whatever. Looking through personnel records, noticed that I had been in the cadet training program and wondered what in the world I was doing driving a truck. And he called me into the office and asked me that very question. I said, well, that's what they classified me and sent me there to do. So
just following orders.
Following orders. So he said, you shouldn't be doing that. He said, with your training and experience, you probably ought to be in something else. He said, I do have an opening in the intelligence office as a clerk. Would you be interested? And I said, oh, yes, I would, definitely. So he sent me over to the intelligence office, where I became part of the 393rd Bomb Squadron intelligence office staff. That's where I remained for the full time I was in the service then. In a tactical unit, the intelligence office isn't the security necessarily, although they do have some security obligations. Their main objective and job is to brief the crews on target areas, also any aerial photographs that we have available, and then after they come back from their mission, an interrogation takes place, and you have to write up a report then for the interrogation, and the intelligence officers more or less judge how successful the mission was, because in the airplanes there were always cameras mounted in there that record the bomb from the time it leaves the airplane till it hits the target area. Clicks every few seconds so that they can target it all the way down to hit the target area, hopefully hit the target area.
So that speaks to your role here. Again, a 19-year-old kid with all this responsibility, but none bigger than keeping that secret. And certainly in retrospect, we can understand why. Tell us about that sign you guys had in Wendover, Utah, because it sounds like that would kind of ingrain this concept in your mind.
It says, what you hear here, what you see here, when you leave here, let it stay here. And they meant it. I saw a full colonel be shipped to Alaska because his tongue got too loose over the bar, I guess. He was shipped out. He was the deputy group commander under Paul Tibbetts. I don't know what he said, but whatever he said got him shipped to Alaska, and that's where he stayed, I guess, for the rest of the war.
And that's a pretty strong deterrent to a young man like you.
Scared to death.
And you hadn't even left the States yet, but we're going to hear about that when we come back. Norris Jernigan will be headed to the National World War II Memorial with Central Valley Honor Flight and that special trip from the former Castle Air Force Base. But nearly 70 years ago, he got the report of the bombing of Hiroshima firsthand from the pilot of the Enola Gay. And he'll tell us what Paul Tibbetts said that day when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, getting an idea today of the kind of stories that you just might dig up if you spend some time with the more than 65 World War II veterans getting ready to take off on an honor flight from the historic runway at the former Castle Air Force Base in Atwater, California. Again, if this is the first you're hearing about honor flight, make sure you go to honorflight.org and find a hub near you to get involved. This isn't just a California thing. If you're listening today on the Rock of Talk in Albuquerque or any of our Hometown Heroes affiliates, I promise there's a way to get involved in your area and give our World War II veterans a chance to experience this before it's too late. Speaking of New Mexico, the man we've been hearing from, Norris Jernigan, still has a piece of glass produced by a bomb test there in New Mexico. Not too many of us have a souvenir quite like that. We've heard how crucial secrecy was as he trained as an intelligence officer with the 509th Composite Group preparing to deploy a weapon that Then-Colonel Paul Tibbetts told the group would shorten World War II by 2 years. And 2 years is about how long you'd been in the Army Air Corps when you headed to the Pacific. And it's pretty amazing that this tiny little strip of land, 39 square miles in the Northern Marianas, that tiny Tinian was going to be the launching point for something that would change the entire world. And I imagine there was a lot of anticipation there. You've been training for the deployment of this top secret weapon, but so far nothing's happened. And I bet there were a lot of people who started to come out of the woodwork there because of the special nature of what you all were working on. Yeah, President Harry Truman, who didn't even know about the Manhattan Project until he assumed the presidency upon FDR's death just a few months earlier. That still amazes me that he had no idea, and then all of a sudden he had to make that fateful decision. What did you expect to happen? Did you have any idea what this gimmick, as you called it, was capable of? Now, I've read, and you can confirm this or correct me on it if I'm wrong, but Paul Tibbetts, of course, named the plane for his mother, Enola Gay Tibbetts, but I've read that that didn't happen, the naming of this B-29, until the night before the mission to Hiroshima. Of course, that mission on August 6, 1945 would drastically alter world history. And in the years after the war, I'm sure you got a sense for the burden that Paul Tibbetts bore, having been the pilot of the plane that dropped that atomic bomb on Hiroshima. That's important to note, and I'm sure a lot of people are hearing that for the first time. And when this mission occurs, the Enola Gay drops this bomb, little boy, on Hiroshima. The B-29 then flies back to Tinian, where you are, and Tibbetts told you all what had happened? And most people know the names Hiroshima and Nagasaki, But I imagine that there are a lot of people listening right now who have never heard that a third city was nearly devastated in the same fashion. Well, I think we're all glad there never was a next one. And we're all thankful we could hear that firsthand account from Norris Jernigan of Visalia, California, who was part of that whole top secret project. And we're thrilled that Mr. Jernigan is headed to Washington, D.C. to experience the National World War II Memorial with dozens of other veterans. And I don't know if there's any veteran on that flight who is more excited about the fact that it's leaving from the former Castle Air Force Base than a man who retired from that base as a lieutenant colonel after 27 years in the Air Force, serving in World War II, Korea, and Vietnam, not to mention the Cold War. His name is B.A. Hansen. He's now 91 years old. He caught the aviation bug after moving from his native Colorado to Southern California, was working in the Douglas Aircraft Factory down there, and could have gotten an exemption because of that. He would not have been drafted in World War II, but he joined the Army Air Corps because he wanted to fly, and boy, has he made the most of that. He's flown just about every aircraft you can imagine, but his favorite, he says, without question, is the P-51 Mustang, which he flew in World War II and Korea. Let's find out what it was about that plane that B.A. Hansen loved so much.
Well, the maneuverability was great, but I did so many other things with the airplane. Dropped bombs, skip bomb, I did aerial gunnery, ground gunnery, and it's just a great airplane to do whatever you want.
Were you itching to get overseas and fly that plane in a serious combat situation?
Yes, due to the fact we knew that we were flying it, that we should do our fair share and do what we could to get there.
You got to England when? In the spring of 1945?
Yes, it was early 45, and I was only over there for a short time. I only had a few missions escorting B-24s and B-17s. I wasn't there long enough to do a whole lot, but I was there. I would like to have done much more, but fortunately we were able to finish the war, and I came home and became an instructor then.
I've talked to so many bomber pilots, many of whom flew missions with or without escort fighters, and they've expressed how thankful they were for the missions where they had fighter escort, like you provided with those P-51s. Can you give us a sense of what it's like to be in that role, to be in that cockpit, flying on the outside of this formation of bombers? And to me, it seems like you've really got to be alert and constantly on edge, looking for the enemy to pop up somewhere. What can you walk us through a mission like that and give us an example of what that experience was like?
We basically, as you mentioned, flew alongside of the bombers. And fortunately, we didn't have a lot of the German aircraft coming up because it was right toward the end of the war. Our basic job was just escorting to keep the other fighters away. That was basically it, and we did have to be very alert, make sure we kept our eyes on the area around us.
I want to hear from you about the end of World War II, because you went over there in early 1945. The war in Europe ends in May of 1945. Do you remember how you found out about that the war in Europe was over, and what that meant to you?
It happened so quick that I guess we didn't give it much thought while we were there. We were glad it was over. We were really interested in getting back to the States.
Well, and you were a new kid on the block over there. You probably didn't have as much points as some of the other guys. Were you concerned that you might be sent to the Pacific to fly over there?
Yes, we knew that could happen, but it didn't happen to me, so I wasn't worried about it.
And what did happen to you is you came back to the States and you spent some time as a flight instructor at an airbase. Tell me about that.
I was at Luke as an instructor on AT-6s, the advanced trainer. I did pretty good on that. I stayed there for probably a little over a year as an instructor and then went to other jobs.
But I guess it was a pretty big deal that you ended up there for that year because if I understand it right, if you hadn't been assigned to Luke Air Base and serving as a flight instructor there, you wouldn't have met your wife? Do I have that right?
That's true. I wouldn't have met her. She was a civilian working on base, and she worked for supply. She worked down on the flight line ordering parts for the aircraft maintenance people. It wasn't long till I met her. I guess that was in late 45, and then in September 46, we got married.
September 46, so I guess about a year after you met her. Did you have to convince her a little bit that she should marry you? Was that an easy sell or a hard sell?
No, really, the way we met, I had finished my cadet class, and I was working on my car. I had a 40 Oldsmobile, and I was working on my car up near my quarters. She and her girlfriend came by. They were on their way to the BX to have lunch. Two of my friends were out watching me work on my car. When the girls came by, they whistled and hubba-hubbed. My wife said when she went home that night, she told her mother that she saw the man she was going to marry. I didn't do any hubba-hubba and whistling, so I guess that's what she liked.
Sounds like one of the wisest moves you ever made. A little self-control goes a long way, huh?
Well, after that, the next day I was finishing up on my car. The girls came by again going to lunch, and I offered them a ride, and that's how we got started. I guess I really didn't have a chance after she said she saw the man she was going to marry.
And she never changed her mind.
She didn't change her mind.
And you have five daughters and 10 grandchildren and 8 great-grandchildren who wouldn't be here had you not been such a gentleman, I guess. So good work. That's a lesson to the rest of us out there to follow your example. Time for our final break, but when we come back, more from B.A. Hansen about some of the other planes he flew and the interesting elements of his service long after World War II. Also, why Castle Air Museum is so special to him. Maybe you can meet him on the way out or the way in with the Central Valley Honor Flight from the former Castle Air Force Base next week. And keep it right here for the rest of Hometown Heroes right after this. You know, one of the things I appreciate so much about the veterans we meet on Hometown Heroes is that they're real. A sincere and genuine spirit really makes an impression on me, and that's why I'm such a big fan of Educational Employees Credit Union. It was EECU that spearheaded the launch of Central Valley Honor Flight with an initial donation of close to $25,000, and the giving did not end there. More than 200,000 members know EECU represents smarter banking, but it's not just about being smart, it's about the heart. I've worked with the folks at EECU for years, and I've watched them put their money where their mouth is, supporting their credit union members right where they live in hometowns up and down Central California. From sponsoring first-class Educator of the Year ceremonies to taking the lead in sending World War II veterans on an unforgettable journey, my friends at EECU keep proving that you are at the heart of everything they do. Go to myeecu.org to see what EECU can do for you, or just walk into any branch. And while you're there, if you enjoy this show, tell them thanks for supporting Hometown Heroes.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, introducing you today to just two of the more than 65 World War II veterans who will make a historic flight from the former Castle Air Force Base to Washington, D.C. with Central Valley Honor Flight, part of the nationwide Honor Flight Network. You can find a hub near you at honorflight.org, and if you're in Central California like I am, I hope you'll help us welcome these veterans home on Wednesday, October 29th. Castle Air Museum will offer free admission starting at 3 p.m., and the flight should touch down around 5:30. On the plane will be 91-year-old B.A. Hansen of Winton, California. He spent 27 years in the U.S. Air Force. We heard about his work in P-51s at the end of World War II, and after coming home from the war and subsequently meeting his wife at Luke Air Force Base in Arizona, he was deployed to Germany, where he became the operations officer for his base, and then took on more extensive duties.
I went to the intelligence school at Oberammergau, Germany. It was an army intelligence school. They also taught us the German language. The reason they had us learn the German language was in case we ran onto prisoners of war that had come back from Russia, possibly we would get intelligence information by interrogating those people.
Yeah, because we're post-World War II now, and really, some would say that the beginning of the Cold War, even though Korea hadn't happened yet, there's this big concern about the communists in Russia and what are they planning. So any intelligence you could glean from people that were their prisoners was going to prove valuable. And that's what you were training for. Do I have that right?
Yes, that's correct.
And in addition to the intelligence work, you were part of a radar early warning squadron. What did that mean?
When I got back from the intelligence school, They sent me to the aircraft early warning squadron. That was at Birkenfeld, Germany. They also made me a radar controller, and we would control the fighters out of Germany, and in case we had aircraft that were unidentified, we would get the fighters up and have them check out those airplanes.
Was that something that happened fairly frequently? Did you experience some times like that?
Yes, quite often we'd get the airplane or get the fighters up and check aircraft that were unidentified. So because I was doing that, they decided that, being I was a pilot, that I could go check out an F-84s and find out what they were doing. So I did. And I like to fly them.
Can you put into words for us the difference, the contrast between that P-51 propeller-powered that you had been flying in World War II to this jet aircraft now, a few years later, the F-84? Did it feel a lot different, the speed of it?
Yes, it did, but really the 86 was a much better airplane than the 84.
And you spent some time flying those and F-106s also?
Yes, I did. I flew, where I flew the F-86 was that I got into the training business. I had a training detachment going from base to base, training on different airplanes. And my first one was on the F-86. That was in New Mexico. I stayed there for about a year, and then they wanted me to go into F-100s. And they sent me to the factory school on the F-100. And then I picked up a training detachment on F-100s and went to Germany and spent a lot of time and went different bases in Germany and different bases. Let's see, I went to France, three bases. And then also over in England to a base. So I was training people on the F-100 in all those different bases.
And by the time your 27 years in the Air Force were over, you'd even fly C-130s. I guess the better question is, what didn't you fly in the Air Force?
Well, before I went to the 130, really, I came back to the States from the 100 training. They were going to send me up into New England, and I was from California, so I thought, since my family was here in California, they didn't go with me overseas. I wanted to come back to the West, so they sent me to C-121s up at McClellan. And I was there for about a year, and then I came to Castle with training detachments. I came and I was training people on the F-102, the B-52, and the KC-135. At one time, I had to probably the biggest school in the country. I had 69 instructors training people on the three airplanes, the 52, the 135, and the 102, and later the F-106. In a three-year period, we did 1 million student hours of training.
That's not just you. That's all the people working under you. But I imagine if you tried to count every pilot that you gave instruction to, I mean, we're talking about hundreds and hundreds of pilots that you helped learn what they had to do for the service, huh?
Yes. We did a lot of training on not only pilots, but also navigators and bombardiers, along with the maintenance people. So I had a big school.
Yeah, I can't imagine that ripple effect, how many people you really had an impact on through all that work and training other pilots. But when the Vietnam War came around, you were deployed again for pretty unique duty, and the plane you were flying this time was a lot bigger than your favorite P-51.
The Vietnam War, I was flying C-130s. I was stationed in Japan, but a month at a time, we'd go down and be in the Vietnam area. We'd fly at 38,000 feet, stay up there for 10 hours at a time. We had, in the back end of our C-130, we had a group of people recording all frequencies that they could get over the airwaves. When we finished, then we'd land and give the information to the intelligence people. The reason I was selected to go into 130s is because I had been an intelligence officer and had a top secret clearance. That's how I was selected to be a pilot in C-130s.
So you guys are up there flying around and they're collecting all this data that would then be passed down and used to decide where troops would go and when to attack a certain spot or things like that. Am I getting the gist of it?
Yes, that's correct. We would stay up there for a long period of time, record all the airwave noise, and we'd get information on what was happening in North Vietnam. And we would stay up there quite a while, and then after we would land, we would give the information to the intelligence people. They would take a look at it, and maybe they could use something for giving in the information to the ground people.
And I'm guessing there was never too much concern about enemy fighters coming up to meet you that high?
Yes, there was. But we knew they were coming because we knew they were being directed our way. Our people in the back end knew they were coming. So knowing that they were coming to get us, we would turn toward the ocean, and the enemy fighters didn't want to come out over the ocean. We would fly on the red line, dive on the red line to get out over the ocean and get out far enough where the fighters didn't want to come after us.
And why wouldn't they want to go that far? It was too dangerous for them?
They didn't want to go out over the water. I don't know why, but we didn't have any problem. Once we got out about 75 to 100 miles, we didn't have any problem.
Again, I'm trying to put myself in your shoes, and I'm hearing what you're saying here. So you're flying a C-130, which is not going to outrace too much that's in the sky and is not going to be able to escape much of these fighters that are coming after it. I mean, you're a bit of a sitting duck if someone actually has a beat on you. And then you actually know from the radio traffic that they're heading your way. Does that put a little fear in you, a little concern?
Well, yes, because we wanted to make sure we got out far enough out over the water, out over the ocean, to keep them from coming after us.
And is there an added element of responsibility or burden there because there were so many others on your airplane? Because you're not the only skin that's on the line here.
Oh, that's right. But there again, we, knowing that nobody wants to get hit by a fighter or for an enemy fighter, and we didn't want that to happen. So they understood what we were doing, that we would try to get out of the way.
I know that in all your years in the Air Force, and certainly the years here at Castle Air Museum since you've been out of the service, you've probably talked to a lot of other pilots. How many guys can say like you can that they flew in World War II, Korea, and Vietnam. Have you met very many others who can claim that?
Not too many. Very few. I do know of individuals that were in maybe one or two, but not all three.
So how much pride does that give you, that you were able to serve your country in all three of those?
Well, yeah, I'm very proud that I was able to do what I could during those three wars.
I don't want to exaggerate, but it seems to me that the impact you were able to have is a lot greater than just your service in those three wars because of all the other pilots that you trained. Do you feel that way, that you had an impact in helping these other pilots go and perform their jobs?
Yes, I knew that once they went through my school, they would go back and do their jobs right. Most of them liked flying the particular airplanes they were in. Most cadets going to different airplanes like the fighters best. I guess it's because they like the speed and the maneuverability. But there are some that prefer to go to the bombers and what have you. But when I was going through school, I definitely wanted to get into fighters because that's what I like to fly.
So, and people still get this confused. I know that Joe Pruzzo here deals with this. Castle Air Force Base was shut down during the Clinton administration, but Castle Air Museum is still here and is a great place to come and explore the history of aviation, especially as it relates to our military. What was it that first hooked you in to Castle Air Museum? And can you tell us how you've been involved here over the years, what kinds of things you've done, and why?
Well, I came here training people on the airplanes at Castle. After I left here, I went back to Japan to fly the 130s over there. When I came back here, I came back to this base because my family was living here, and we've stayed here, and being I was a Californian anyway, I liked it.
What is it about this museum that that makes you want to support it the way you have, and what makes this place special? Why is it worth supporting and keeping alive?
Because keep the airplanes in good order for people to come and look at. There's a lot of history and a lot of good information that people can come and look at. They've heard a lot of the war and what have you that we were in. They've known that different airplanes were doing different things in the different wars. We have those airplanes here at Castle. We have them, and so the people want to come here and see them, and we like to keep them in darn good shape.
That's for sure, and you can see for yourself this Wednesday when the latest Central Valley Honor Flight returns from Washington, D.C. We're looking for a record crowd there in Atwater. The Atwater High School Band will be performing. Cheerleaders from their rival, Buhat Colony Thunder, will be there. You can see a B-25 up close and personal on the flight line where this flight's going to touch down. And if you get there early, Castle Air Museum is offering free admission starting at 3 p.m. It's going to be an unforgettable day, Wednesday, October 29th, and I hope all of you listening in Central California can join us. If you're listening on one of our other Hometown Heroes affiliates, hopefully you can be a part of something just like this in your area. We're out of time this time on Hometown Heroes. Thanks for spending the hour with us. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.